come up on a tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alita Sines. And we're both sitting across from
Sergio Troncoso, who's our guest today here in the studio.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. And why don't we tell people not that people don't know who you are. In El Paso, everybody knows who Sergio Troncoso is. In fact, they just recently named a library branch after this guy right here.
In Isleta. You know why?
Isleta, the best part of town, by the way.
It's the best part of town? Well, you know, it's because, you know, Sergio's from Isleta, and so they named a library after him. And
well, you know, I'm from Fresno. I don't have a library named after me. What's up with that?
Well, you know, I don't know.
Let me give a brief bio of Sergio before we continue the show.
Okay, Mr. Library.
Sergio Troncoso is a writer of essays, short stories, and novels. He was born and grew up in El Paso, Texas, the son of Mexican immigrants. After graduating from Harvard College, he studied international relations and philosophy at Yale University. Troncoso was inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters and the Hispanic Scholarship Fund's Alumni Hall of Fame. He is a resident faculty member of the Yale Writers Conference and an instructor at the Hudson Valley Writers Center. For news, visit his website at sergiotroncoso.com. I think I'm going to do that.
Awesome.
Sergio, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hey, thank you. I love being on the show. You know, you guys are it in terms of literature and the border. So it's terrific always to see you and read you, actually. I'm always waiting for the next book from Daniel and Ben.
Let's talk about El Paso. What's your favorite part of El Paso, really? What are your favorite parts of El Paso?
Well, I mean, you know, I love Isleta, and I've always loved Isleta. I've been here for about 4 or 5 days, and eating La Tapatía, you know, going out and getting a chile relleno burrito in the mornings. I'd love actually just going on the cotton fields, like towards Saneli, towards in Isleta. And just seeing the sunrise, I love to get up really early in the morning.
You know, La Tapatía, by the way, has the best tamales in town.
They do. Absolutely. Absolutely. No me digas nada de La Tapatía.
A lot of our listeners don't actually live in El Paso. Give a little background of what Isleta's like, just so they can kind of get an
Well, you know, Isleta, a long time ago, was not even part of El Paso. It was actually at a certain point, it was its own little town, and it's been around before El Paso was even El Paso in the 1600s.
Wow.
So it's sort of an ancient community in many ways. And then the Tigua community is right next to the Isleta Mission, and it's kind of more rural, and it's on the outskirts. And over time, I mean, now it's just a suburb of El Paso, and it was annexed by El Paso. And but my parents moved there in the 60s, in the early 60s, when it was basically a colonia. There was no electricity yet, and there was no running water. We had an outhouse in the backyard, you know, which we had to dig ourselves. And by the way, talk about a dirty job, especially when the outhouse collapses and you have to dig it out again. And so we would steal. Yeah, andale. Ben is making a face. But imagine doing that job as a kid. And so we actually would steal old railroad ties to buttress the sides of the sand to make sure the thing would not collapse again.
Well, I'm making a face because I remember an outhouse. I had an outhouse. I, you know, grew up using an outhouse when I grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I kind of like indoor plumbing.
No, absolutely. I love indoor plumbing.
Well, you know, you guys both had outhouses. I had it even rougher. I had a house with our family, and we only had one bathroom.
Well, that's tough.
Boy, did we fight over it. Seriously, there is a library in Isleta now called the Sergio Troncoso Library.
Well, you know, they voted, the city council voted unanimously at the end of July to rename the Isleta Library branch after me. So what it means to me is that I hope it encourages poor kids to read from the area and from the neighborhood. You know, I'm from the neighborhood. My parents still live in the same house that they built. My brothers are teachers here, and I come back all the time. And in fact, I was just meeting with the staff of the library on Friday. Some of the things we're going to do once they have the naming ceremony.
Nice. When would that be?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, because it's sort of a public bid process. Everything is part of the government, so you got to put up the sign up. Somebody has to bid for it, and then they have to install it, and then it'll
be back. Well, it's going to be a big deal then. It's going to be a pachanga.
A pachanga. Well, I hope so. I want to do things with the schools and the library that haven't yet been done, and really make it a focal point in a way that I can, encourage. But, it's to encourage poor kids and kids in the neighborhood to read and focus. I was this chubby kid from Isleta, and I haven't really changed. Estoy un poco gordito. You can't see that on the radio. But
we can hear it in your voice, bro.
But, I'd love to read. I amassed hundreds and hundreds of these little scholastic paperbacks as a kid from South Loop School. Every penny I had was to buy these little paperbacks. And I'd love to read. And it was very different from what it was.
They used to cost 25 cents
or
35 cents.
Sometimes even cheaper if you got them used. Sometimes the dime.
I used to order them from the Weekly Reader.
Yeah. Yeah.
You still read the Scholastic books. That's awesome.
No.
That's why you're such a good YA. Oh, you don't? Oh.
Not anymore. I stopped that.
You know what my favorite children's book was?
What?
Danny and the Dinosaur. And not just because it had my name, but it was a great book.
And you know what mine was?
What?
It was The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton. That was then, this is now.
Now we're talking about different levels of books.
You're talking about YA. I'm talking about children's.
Well, I mean, even younger than that. But,
I think
what I remember.
My favorite book when I was like around sixth grade is still one of my favorite books, The Little Prince.
Oh, yeah, that's a good book.
All right, let's go a little earlier, The Cat in the Hat. I had all those green eggs and ham, all the Dr. Seuss stuff.
Oh, the Star-Belly Sneetches. That was my favorite. I used to read it over and over again.
Aspect of Dr. Seuss.
You didn't like the Dick and Jane ones? See Spot Run?
No, are you kidding?
Yeah, you can't like that. You just learn that.
I mean, that was boring. Dr. Seuss was exciting.
What about the Bernstein Bears? I always felt sorry for that loser old dad. I think he's kind of an archetype for Homer and maybe even influenced Homer Simpson. And with Little Bart, meaning the little bear.
I
really kind of had a boyhood crush on Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Yeah,
Eeyore, really?
He was always depressed.
Eeyore. I know, but I liked him.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
Well,
I liked Pigpen in Charlie Brown. I really loved Pigpen. I really thought I liked that he kind of refused to take a bath.
Yeah. I like Winnie.
That makes a lot of sense now that you mention it, Ben. No kidding.
So what is your favorite restaurant in El Paso besides the Tapatia?
Well, it changes all the time. I'm trying to think of I just had breakfast at Elmer's, which was,
On Montana.
That's really old school.
Yeah. It's very old school.
$1.99 breakfast, two eggs.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
two pieces of bacon.
Simple, relaxed. They give me a lot of coffee and it's just quiet. And so I enjoy those kind of places.
We're talking.
Yo nunca me creo muy, muy.
That
comes from Isleta, by the way.
Well, you do live in New York.
Upper West Side,
Upper
mind
West
you.
Side. I think one of the nicest places to go eat on Monday night, taco night at the Riviera.
Wait, where's the Riviera?
I've never
heard
of
that. It's on Donovan.
Yeah,
it's on Donovan.
Is it worth
yes,
the
it
drive?
Is. Yes, it is. Monday,
so
Monday
they only have tacos on Monday night?
No, but it's taco night. That means it's all you can eat tacos.
Taco night.
All you can eat.
All you can eat
for
tacos
how much?
Monday night. I don't know, Daniel.
What do you mean you don't know? You're over here telling us you like it because it's all you can eat. You don't even know the price? Like $40?
No, it's really good. And, of course, I like to go to Chico's Tacos on Alameda because it's a scene.
Right.
I don't love Chico's Tacos. I'm going to make that. I'm confessing that on the air.
Neither do I.
I don't love Chico's Tacos, but I like going there.
Right.
When I first moved to El Paso, so many people took me to Chico's Tacos. They were very proud of it. And when I saw those little rolled tacos swimming in that juice, I said, there's no way I'm going to drink that juice. And so I ordered a hot dog, and they served it in a hamburger bun. it was the worst hot dog. No disrespect, El Paso, but Chico's Tacos is really not your haute cuisine. Sergio Troncoso. We're talking to Sergio Troncoso. He's in the studio with us today.
Can I just point out one other culinary thing that I did that I think you guys are missing out?
Okay.
Licon's Dairy. Have you been
to Asaderos? Oh, I have been to Licon's Dairy, and they have the best asaderos in the world.
Yeah. They have great cheese.
I mean, it's
there.
Not a restaurant, but those asaderos are a little heaven in your mouth.
I haven't been there in years. I should go out
anyway,
there again.
Sorry to interrupt you, Daniel.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to segue. We have Sergio Troncoso, and a writer of how many books now is it?
Five.
Five books. Yeah. And one of them was called The Nature of Truth, and it came out with Northwestern Press, I think. But you recently republished it with Arte Publico.
Right.
And so what was that about? Why did you decide to republish this book, and what did you do differently about it?
Well, you know, it was a bit of an a lark. I was in between books, and I had a summer free, and I said, I can do this novel better. Mm. And so I rewrote it without asking anybody or telling anybody.
That's brave.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, I've
wanted to do that with stuff. I wanted to redo it, but I never actually take the time to do it. But you just committed yourself to do it.
That's... Well, you know, it was like an intellectual exercise. And so I wanted to tighten the language. I think there were two points in the plot that I wanted to change slightly that are important for character motivation. And one of them I hope I can read today.
Yeah,
and
on Poetic License today, we're going to have you read an excerpt from this.
Yeah. It's a novel that, for me, in many ways, sets up the intellectual framework for some of the work that follows, some of the novels that follow. People don't understand that I'm actually trying to do something with all my work rather than just, you know, what's the next story I want to tell.
Right, right.
And so, you know, I always come back to philosophy and literature. That's why I studied and learned German, and I was, you know, happy to hear that some of Ben's books are coming out in German. You know, I loved reading Thomas
Aristotle
Mann.
Aristotle und Dante.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, but, you know, the Germans do this all the time, and other people do, but they're primarily known for that. And I love reading Heidegger and Nietzsche, and so I have this big philosophical background. And I wanted to just leave this book as best as I could. I'm sure, you know, I have already found mistakes or things that I would have changed, but I'm not going to do it a third time. So I rewrote it. At that point, I had my first book with Arte Publico, and I pitched it to them, and they took it in like 2 or 3 weeks.
Nice.
It's like ridiculously on the quick side, and that's how it happened.
Yes. You're both with Arte Publico.
Yeah. Yeah, my last book was my first and my last book were with Arte.
Yeah, Arte Publico is great.
They're doing it. They did a great job with Hotel Juarez. Yeah. I mean, they're very, very supportive.
Yeah. And Marina Tristan, you know, is so great. And Nicolas Canelos, you know, is good. And all of
that's funny. Marina's supportive. Great. Nicolas is good. I'm going to tell
you. No, they're all great. I mean, they all know, I know
kidding,
Nicolas very well. But, you know, they're all great. But the person you deal with day to day is more Marina.
Marina's amazing. So The Nature of Truth, why didn't you change the title to The Nature of the Real Truth since it's kind of different?
Because it's really a novel about the quest for the truth and how it become an obsession.
And it's a different novel for you because most of your novels take place in Isleta, and they're usually poor families or not very.
Well, Helmut is not exactly rich.
Yeah, but that's not what I mean, though. Uh-huh. I mean, he's already he's at Yale, I think he is. I mean, it's not the story of an Isleta family. It's really almost more, you could probably compare it more to Bolaño in the sense that the mystery is an intellectual question. And and the plot runs along, the parallels of philosophy and, asking these big questions. It's really interesting. Was it a challenge for you to write something completely different from what you usually write?
No, because I think, you know, if you look at The Last Tortilla, for example, the very first story I wrote and the story that's in The Last Tortilla, The Abuelita, it's about a Chicano at Yale calling his Mexican grandmother and talking about Heidegger. And so it's not that much of a stretch in my mind. But, you know, it's Helmut Sanchez is a protagonist in the Nature of Truth.
It's a great name, Helmut Sanchez.
He's half German and half Mexicano. And he's really getting away from his whole German heritage and trying to reconnect with his mother, who's from New Mexico. He finds this old letter in the Yale libraries and that says some horrible things about the Holocaust. And he sets out to find out the truth behind who wrote this letter. And an old professor who is his boss, Werner Hofgartner, who's about to retire, is probably the writer of this letter. And then Helmut travels with his girlfriend, Arianna Sassolini, to Italy and Austria to find out the truth behind Hofgartner's career and history that he's hidden. And so one of the, I mean, the two major questions, I think, in the novel that I think certainly play out in some of my other work is how much does past and the past transgressions matter versus what you're doing now and current transgressions, moral transgressions, and how much do words matter versus actions? And this is fundamentally a question in Aristotle. Because, you know, all of it, and this is, by the way, a question for all of us as writers. Sometimes we're just sitting in a small office writing. You know, how much more should we be doing in terms of action to either change things, help our community? And Helmut is faced with this, you know, in terms of he sees this letter. He can just besmirch the professor, but he doesn't think that's enough. Yeah. He doesn't think that even close to enough. He needs to do something, not just bring him down from his university perch.
And this novel just came out with Arte Público 2014.
Yeah.
The Nature of Truth by Sergio Troncoso. And on Poetic License, in a little bit, we're going to have you read an mm-hmm. excerpt from it. But when I first moved to El Paso, like 14 years ago, people would always say, "Hey, do you know Sergio Troncoso?" And I go, no, I don't know. Because you had one book at the time. It was the mm-hmm. The last tortilla, and it had just won the Aztlan, the Premio Aztlan. Mm-hmm. And so I was hanging out with somebody. She told me about your book. And I go, "No, I haven't heard." She goes, "Oh, well, here, let me, you know, you can borrow it." So she lent me her copy, and it was signed to her by you. And I never gave it back. I lost contact with it. So on my shelf, I still have her copy. And if she's listening, you know, you can have it back if you want. I suppose I could buy my own copy.
I'll give you a copy.
Oh, thank you. But I read it and really enjoyed it and was glad to get to know you. You are very, very connected to not only the writing community, but specifically the Latino writing community. I mean, everybody knows you. And it seems like a lot of the important writers that we know, I won't mention any names, they go to you for advice. You're like a confidant.
Well, you could say Sleta. You could say, you know, I mean, I've always said, by the way, because, you know, people say you went to Harvard and you went to Yale and now you sort of teach at Yale. And they put these places up on a pedestal. And that's actually something I don't want people to do, because I've always said Isleta has as much to teach Harvard and Yale as Harvard and Yale had mm-hmm. to teach Isleta. And so I think if you remain grounded in what you're doing and you don't have any agendas, you're just trying to produce good work and encouraging the work of others who's great, that should be the only thing you're doing. You know, not the personalities. Too often, I think, as writers, I see a lot of writers, some young, some old, who get into the author as personality. And, you know, I don't believe that. I think that's a wrong way to take literature. And, you know, they want to be famous or they want to be whatever. It should be about the writing. It should be about the story. Then it should be about even experimentation. You know, that the tent of American literature should be very broad and wide, and that we should not relegate ourselves to Latino literature not being about books of ideas and things like that.
But I want to get back to something that you said about writing and action.
Right.
Because in some ways, writing is an action. And I'm not sure, you know, because I'm pretty involved in the community and I get involved in immigration issues right. or what have you. And that's important to me. I'm something of an activist and I'm very happy to be involved on the grassroots level. That said, I know that, for instance, with particularly my last young adult novel, that I've touched a lot of men's lives. I've touched a lot of gay men's lives. And I'm not just talking about kids. And I have men my age or older writing me letters saying that when they read this book, they wish they had this book when they were growing up. And they say, "And reading this book has healed the hurt boy in me." That's also action. And I don't think a week goes by that I don't get one or two letters about Aristotle and Dante and about what that book means to young people and old, all kinds of people, educators. And so that is an action. I think a lot depends on who we write for right. and our audience and who reads us. I think poetry touches fewer people than, say, novels. Mm. I think that's true. I think that's too bad, but I think that's also the truth. But I also think that I know that when I write a book of poems, I always get people that are wanting to read the book. And I think that reading is still an important thing, and I think it touches people. That's why we write. And right. that, and for writers, that is also action. But I also think that we have to step out of that.
Right.
And I think teaching does that too. When I'm a teacher, I'm not being a writer.
Right.
I'm being a teacher. And over the years, I've been here teaching for 22 years. It's a lot of lives.
Yeah. No, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not my comment is not to say either or. And that's not what I meant. And I think you're right. You know, when you sit down and you write a book, you are producing something. You know, you are acting. And my comment was much more at a fundamental level to, in a sense, bring some humility to what we do. You know, that we're privileged, we're writing, we're producing books. And I have a lot of admiration for somebody who does something that has very little to do with intellect, but has another sense of craft to it, like being a father or like being a mother or like being, you know, something that takes 20 years simply because I have kids, you know, and I've known the hard work it's taken to learn to be a good father, the mistakes I've made. And all of that for me, you know, it balances out what I am as a writer. So I don't somehow tend to think because I'm a writer, this other life that I have as a father, as a husband, is less. And so it's at a much more fundamental level. It's actually not saying that writers are not actors, because they are, but it's also putting in perspective what writing is versus in relation to the greater part of the world.
Well, I think what you're getting at is that living is an art.
Right.
And one of the things that I've learned as a writer, as a teacher, I thought I was teaching my students craft, and I would focus in on all of that. But you know, you can learn the plumbing of something, and not be a good architect.
Right.
You know, you can learn how to build a basic house, but it's not necessarily a beautiful house.
Right.
Because architects are artists.
Right.
Real true architects are artists, and so it's about something else. And I now realize that we bring ourselves to the table, and it's the person that's writing it that makes it art.
Yeah.
You can learn dialogue. You can learn internal. You can learn point of view. You can learn first person. You can learn omniscient. You can learn all of those right. techniques, and it won't make you a writer if there's not something inside of you that is empathetic and generous.
Right. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we're able to teach computers how to write stories, but they're not going to be very good because they lack that passion. They lack
that spirit, that yeah. soul, whatever we
Duende.
You know.
They lack duende. On one level. You can
and
say
they lack our flaws.
Duende.
They yeah. lack our flaws.
Because I think that there's craft, but I think one of the things that makes art is our passion that fights against the craft, that pushes on the boundaries of craft. And I think something that's just completely well crafted is boring.
Right.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. If you look at the work of Picasso, you knew that as a really young boy, almost he was, you know, not even a teenager, he could draw perfectly.
Oh, yeah. He could do hyper-realism at 16.
And you know, it's like he wasn't interested in that. Yes, I can draw. I can look at a human being and I can sit down and I can just draw them perfectly just like that.
Mm-hmm.
What made him an artist is his intellectual curiosity, his experimentation, his willingness to just do something different. And he produced beautiful art.
And his passion. He was an incredibly passionate man all the way until his death. And, you know, sometimes that passion manifested itself in, you know, exploitation of his partners. But he was incredibly passionate and always just an inquietude
right.
about him.
No, it's true. I mean, and it's, I think all of us who are, you know, who are digging, you know, as Seamus Heaney would say, digging mm-hmm. into our lives, self-criticism, our failures and our and writing about it and our successes and then, you know, digging again. I think it's this kind of work, this constant work, and it's not relegated just to being in the library writing a book, but it's to our families, to what we do as human beings. It is about, you know, being an artist in the complete sense, not just in terms of, you know, producing a book that's commercially successful and stuff. And it kind of makes me angry sometimes that's in this culture is too often that's how people are measured.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, and it's I think it's a misplaced of values.
You know, I think of Borges, his very first book. I think it was called Fervor de Buenos Aires. It was a collection of poems. He self-published it and gave it away to friends, you know. And today, you know, there are just so many books coming out. It's really kind of, there's a lot of voices out there. And
good ones.
And that's great.
A lot of good ones, yeah. And but, it becomes a question of, your next book depends on how well your first book sold.
Right.
Well, certainly in New York publishing houses, it really is a bottom line industry.
But I think it's even so in university presses, even though they don't say it, I think a university press will publish you again if your first book sold.
Can I ask you guys a question? Because this is a question I wrestled with recently with a friend. We were talking about Colin McCann came and talked to us at Yale, and he was talking about radical empathy, how writers, you know, one of the things he's trying to foster is radical empathy of other communities. And a question that we talked to him about and other people about is empathy among the audience, in which why aren't people in the broader community reading a Ben Sines or reading Daniel Chacón? Who are not necessarily Latino, and there are, but why aren't there more rather than seeing us as just, we're in this box. We're not in this box.
I don't know the answer to that. I do think that in terms of, the interesting thing for me is like, my young adult audience isn't Latino.
That's good.
I mean, it is, but most of my readers in the young adult world are not Hispanic. Mm-hmm. But I would think that a lot of my readers, interestingly enough, to get to that question, there was a lot of people who I've heard comments about everything begins and ends at the Kentucky Club. Mm-hmm. They don't like the gay stuff.
Right.
Where's their empathy? It's like, are you saying
that's true?
It just isn't my thing. They'll say, oh, it just isn't my thing. And I'm thinking like, really? You know, I read like straight literature like most of the time, and you know, like for me to say it isn't my thing is ludicrous and mean-spirited and close-minded. There's so many communities out there,
right?
And then we belong to so many. But it's true that overall that mostly Latinos read Latino literature. That's mostly true.
Mostly true. Yeah, I mean my question is about cross-group, cross-cultural empathy from the audience to the writers who are writing, you know. And so many times, you know, people have read my story and said, wow, you use a lot of philosophy in your stories. Like, they're shocked, and they're not Latinos. And, you know, you've been judged simply by your name without actually reading the story.
If there is no abuelita making tortillas on a comal in your story, how could you call yourself a Chicano?
Exactly.
We're going to close up this conversation with Sergio Troncoso, and we'd like you to do a segment of Poetic License, if you can.
So I'm going to read right at the midpoint of the novel, and Hellman, at this point, he's traveled to Austria, and he's tried to find out what his boss did, and this is at the point in the novel where he decides to do something about it, action. It was inky black in the small bend in the pathway. Through the bramble of leaves and branches, Helmut could hardly see the road and river beyond. Behind him, the leafy underbrush rose precipitously. He had a clear view of the entrance to and exit from this bend. A street light by the Mill River Dam, a single bulb of amber light, barely illuminated the shadowy murk. He yanked open his backpack and almost plunged his hand straight in. Was he out of his mind? He patted the inside pockets of his leather jacket and found its gloves. Why wasn't he wearing gloves when he fell on Prospect? He thrust his hands into the furry lining. He knew his blood would smear the gloves inside, but what choice did he have? Then he gripped the knife, which felt heavier than before, like a sword, and set it down beside him. He closed his backpack and pushed it out of the way. The knife was in his left hand. Through the gloves, a sharp coldness surrounded his fingertips. Helmut heard only the wind through the pine trees. The street was quiet. He waited for what seemed like hours, and still nothing. Crouching on his toes, he shifted his weight around. His left hand ached. Where was Werner Hofgartner? Had he taken a different way home? Helmut's head was dizzy. Would he truly murder Werner Hofgartner? Minor hot spots of pain erupted over his body. Helmut imagined Anja Litvak in pain and all alone. He imagined Anja in the trees above him, waiting too and wanting what he wanted. But why should he be the one? Why should he soil his hands too? He was not like Werner Hofgartner. He wasn't. What on earth had his evil mind done to him? Helmut thought, exhaling for what appeared to be the first time that night. Helmut was about to get up and run down Whitney Avenue, but then he heard the distinctive click of the cane on the ice and distant footsteps. The footsteps were getting closer, just coming around the bend. A wave of fear suddenly hits Helmut's face. What was he doing? Why was he here? Bits of snow cracked underfoot, not more than a few feet away. A certain elation mixed with dread overtook Helmut like a red cloud. Werner Hofgartner took the slight turn of the pathway into the trees. The knife dropped from Helmut's hand and clanged against a rock. Who's there? I know someone's there. Helmut hesitated for a moment. His vision was blurred. Tears streamed down his cheeks. You awful human being. You bastard. I know about Mühldorf. I know about Anja. Helmut? What? Is that you? You monster, Helmut screamed at Professor Hofgartner, standing a few feet away in the half-light. You disgusting animal! You don't deserve to live! Amid the shadows, Helmut could see and not see the professor's blue eyes. Hofgartner held up his walking stick with the lance-like metal edge pointed at him. I know! So you do. I see, said the professor in a steady, deep voice Helmut had never heard before. It reminded him of a bear's growl. Hofgartner planted his legs apart and grabbed his walking stick with both hands. I found out everything. I had the documents, you liar, you murderer. The blood pumped wildly through Helmut's head in a red frenzy, and he felt dizzy. He wanted to vomit. You have been an even better researcher than I imagined. But this truth will stay between us. It will never escape these shadows, you young idiot. I'll tell everyone, you monster. What a stupid, stupid boy you are. Suddenly Helmut's figure disappeared into the shadows, and Hofgartner's, a heavy blow from the walking stick's sharp metal edge, smacked Helmut square on the left temple. Stars erupted in front of Helmut's eyes, and he crumpled to the ground. Another blow struck him on the neck. Another cracked against his ribs. Hofgartner was on top of him, the stick gripped in his hands, the stick against Helmut's throat. The professor was choking Helmut. I'll stop right there.
That was Sergio Troncoso reading from his latest novel, The Nature of Truth. Thank you, Sergio.
And if that doesn't make you want to read his book, nothing will.
Sergio, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Daniel and Ben. I think you're my heroes in many ways. And I am always privileged to be on your show.
Well, thank you.
It's our pleasure.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz.
Don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circle.